So, let's see. Carolyn dropped this book by the other week, and so Thich Nhat Hanh, being of peace. And so earlier in the week, I was having breakfast, and this was sitting on the dining room table. I picked it up and just opened it, and I came to this passage, which was like, oh, and so I'm going to read that, the passage to you, and that's what I want to talk about tonight. When we say, I take refuge in the Buddha, we can also understand that the Buddha takes refuge in me. Because without the second part, the first part isn't complete. The Buddha needs us for awakening, understanding, and love to be real things and not just concepts. They must be real things that have real effects on life. Whenever I say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I hear, Buddha takes refuge in me. So, that's interesting. So, by way of sort of thinking about that and talking about that, let me start with what effect that had on me all this week and what I've been thinking about this week, which is a result of that particular passage. And it's going to sound very Zen if you're sort of like hear a lot of Zen talks. And that is that in this moment, in this very moment, right now, but any moment, in this very moment, everything that's ever happened to me, to us, has come together and is right here in this very moment. Right now. Now, how did I get to that from the passage that I just read, and why have I been sort of thinking about this all this week? So that's what I'll try and explain. I don't know how well I'll do, but I'll give it a shot. Well, for one thing, what's obvious is that this very moment, and what I just said, is dependent upon Carolyn giving me this book. So what I'm saying tonight to you, this talk of our, we are being here together and talking about this, is completely dependent on Carolyn. Because if Carolyn hadn't given me the book, well, she gave the book to both of us, but if she hadn't brought the book over here, then that's not what we would be talking about today. We'd all be here, but something else would be going on. So that's one way in which one can think about how everything in our lives comes together in this very moment. But you can sort of unwind it much more fully. For example, and with implicating many more people in many more situations. So I've been thinking a lot about being here on the Grand and how it happened that we're on the Grand. And so that sort of implicates decisions that were made when we lived in Santa Fe or when we lived in Flagstaff or when we lived in San Francisco. And in particular, a specific decision when we were sitting on a swing in our backyard in San Francisco when Kay said, I got to get out of here. I can't stand it anymore. And I said, okay. So that particular moment is very strong in my mind. I mean, it's a moment that was maybe 11 years in the past now, but I remember it very distinctly. Because that was like one of those forks in the road in your life. You know, if I said, no way, I'm never leaving San Francisco, and if you want to leave, that's okay, but you're going without me. Well, then I certainly wouldn't be sitting in the Grand talking with you. But that's not what I said. So all of that stuff that led up to that conversation and that decision, and what was wrapped up in that, that led us to Santa Fe, that led us to Flagstaff, that led us here. All that stuff is here, because if that hadn't happened, Kay and I wouldn't be here. So then we wouldn't be sitting in this house having this conversation. That's pretty simple and straightforward. But then I'm thinking about this house. So now we're into a whole bunch of other people because we spent the afternoon wrestling with plumbing. Okay. Now, if you live in an old house and you're wrestling with plumbing, then there are a lot of things that you're dealing with, like the previous owners who you don't even know, and decisions that they made. And then there are things like rust and age and natural processes. And other decisions that were made, like, well, I'm going to have a garden with a drip system. And so now we have issues with water pressure and bibs on the outside of houses that don't do things like we'd like them to do for them to work with a drip system. Therefore, there's our whole afternoon. So on the one hand, there's the physical house, but then the frame of mind that we're in, you know, is wrapped up in things. It's like, how come I didn't shave? You know, like usually if I'm going to do this sort of thing, I'll at least shave. But, nah, this is a funky day. So I didn't even shave, you know. So all that stuff comes together. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about that a lot. He says, for example, I think that this is the most famous illustration of this. And I think it actually is famous. He says, you're sitting here and you're reading my book, essentially. And do you see the clouds in the trees? Do you see the clouds in the book? Do you see the clouds in the paper? Because the rain that nourished the trees, that kept the trees alive, made it possible for the trees to be turned into paper and the people who did, you know, all that kind of stuff. But if that rain hadn't fallen on those trees, that there would be different paper that I would be looking at and I'm reading, but there wouldn't be that paper that I was looking at reading. Those specific trees are in that book. And those clouds are in that book that Carolyn gave us, that led us to this talk. So everything is implicated in this very moment. Right? Now, the Buddhist way of talking about that is to say that what's happening in this moment is dependent upon all that other stuff, and that we're connected with all that other stuff, even though most of the time we don't notice that. We go around and moment by moment we engage with what's going on as if it's completely there as it presents itself, but disconnected from everything else, independent. So that's the big mistake. That's the big mistake that human beings make, according to Buddhists. And they actually call that ignorance. So ignorance is a Buddhist term that has it's a technical term. In Buddhism, the Sanskrit is avidya. A means not. Vid, no. Not knowing. Avidya. And it's a specific way of not knowing. It's not just, I didn't get educated and so I'm working at a gas station not knowing. It's not just, I never took a course on calculus, so I don't understand how calculus works. It's not that kind of not knowing. It's a specific kind of not knowing, of not knowing how things connect with each other, which is pervasive for all beings, not just all human beings, according to Buddhists. Even the kitties suffer from this problem. Even the cats suffer from this problem. Even the birds and the trees, everything that's alive, except for plants, which aren't sentient, suffers from this avidya. Now, I'm not going to get into how does the Buddha know that kind of thing. We just take it for granted that that's what they say and move on to another subject, because that would be a sidetrack, which I don't want to get to. I could see that Mary was getting very in it. We could get to this question later.
No, okay, let's do it another time.
Yeah. Well, we can do that this evening, but if we get there now, I'll get sidetracked and being, you know, elderly.
I didn't say a word.
Yeah, but I could see what was happening, you know. We know each other well enough.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
So being elderly, if I get too sidetracked, we're going to be in trouble. So let me get back to the main thing here. So, this avidya has us, you know, seeing everything independent of, or autonomous of everything else. And that's the big problem. So, you know, in the 50s, we remember the 1950s, they talked about people being alienated I think that was great language. You know, people are alienated from their environment, alienated from each other. And if you think about the Tara Tulku article, he talks about that. I don't remember if he actually used the word alienated or not, but there was some way in which he talked about the way in which people are disconnected from each other, and I can't quite recall what it was. But the main Buddhist idea is that we go through our lives experiencing ourselves as being disconnected from everything that's going on around us, and in fact disconnected from our own history, from each other, and fundamentally in a certain way from our own lives. And this is an error of knowledge of vidya. And because it's an error of knowledge, there's actually something you can do about it. Because if there's a vidya, there's vidya. There is knowing, there's correct knowing, and you can cultivate correct knowing. So if you cultivate correct knowing, then what's going on? Well, cultivating correct knowing is a matter of seeing how things connect with each other. And to use the Zen language, probably Zen language, is to see that the entirety of everything that's ever happened is present and manifest in this very moment. So if you try and remember that, then that becomes a practice. If you try and remember that in this very moment, the entire history of your life and everybody else's life has come together and is right here. Now that may not seem like it's a big deal to do that, but if you try doing it, it's really, I mean, it gets kind of interesting and kind of amazing. My first exposure to this, and I may have told you this story, but my first exposure to this way of thinking about things was I had been studying this kind of philosophy in kind of an abstract way for quite a number of years. I actually wrote my doctoral dissertation on the subject, and although there's another side to it, which is called emptiness, I'll maybe get to that.
So
emptiness. The other way of talking about everything arising in dependence on everything else, which is sometimes referred to as emptiness, and I'll bracket why that is for a moment. So I'd been studying this philosophically for a long time, actually, 4, 5, 6 years, and it had only penetrated so deeply because I'd been thinking about it only philosophically, and I hadn't brought it into a meditative practice, and therefore it wasn't inducing a change in me. It was sort of staying in my frontal lobes or some other part of my anatomy. It wasn't penetrating any more deeply. So I remember this particular instance of what happened, that I got it, and that it wasn't just something that was abstract, which was, I was living in Amherst, Massachusetts, and at the time I was working at Amherst College, and Bob Thurman was teaching at Amherst College. He was associate professor of religious studies there. And he had organized for about a 7, 8, 9 month period a lama to come and stay there called Tara Tulku, who became my teacher and became Kay's teacher also later. And so he would teach classes, Tara Rinpoche would teach classes at the college during the day, and then in the evening he would often teach classes in Bob Thurman's attic. He had one of these huge old Massachusetts houses that he rented cheaply from the university. He converted the attic into a meditation hall, which was too cold in the winter and too hot in the summer. Right. So anyhow, we were sitting up there in the one winter, and it was, you know, snowy Massachusetts winter, and we're talking about whatever he was talking about. Anyhow, he got into talking about this dependent origination, to use a Buddhist term. The Sanskrit for, if you're curious, is Pratitya Samutpada. So he got to talking about this, and then he used an example. And he said, when you leave here to go home, you'll be walking on some roads to get home. He said, well, those roads didn't just get there. Somebody had to do something to make those roads be there. I mean, there were people who laid concrete, not concrete, laid the asphalt after other people had done the grading. And then, of course, the city council was making some decision to bring it together. And there was tax money that went into it, so everybody in the community made this contribution to bring this together. And there's this nice road for you to walk home on. And of course, since he'd spent his time in India and Tibet, he understood that roads are not a given, especially not nice roads. And he said, and it's all covered with snow, but by the time you leave here, some snow plow will come along and some really nice person will have pushed the snow out of the way so you can walk down this road without clopping through all this snow and go home on this cold, snowy night. And I thought, yeah, that's true. And it was like, you know, in the cartoons, the light bulb goes boing on top of your head. And at that, in that moment, this abstraction of how things connect with each other and depend on each other, you know, it was like, oh, yeah. You know, I had not seen it in the concreteness of a specific situation. And then when I walked home, I thought about all the nice people who plowed the road and laid the asphalt. And I thought, oh, this is a meditation practice. This is being in the moment and recognizing how the entire history of entire communities of beings comes together in one moment to support each other and to support me. And they didn't do it for me, but they did do it for me. And I'm benefiting from what they did just as everybody else is benefiting from what they did. And that whole community and that whole community effort of all those beings is right there in that moment of my walking down that road in snow that is only 2 inches deep at the most instead of a foot and a half because it had snowed like crazy at that particular point in Massachusetts that winter. It's like, so my ability to walk down that road was dependent on the kindness, and that was his way of talking about it, on the kindness of so many beings, which is manifest in that moment. And I realized that this was not just my idea of a Buddhist meditation, this was a Buddhist meditation. And that's what I had been taught in a very up-to-date, practical, simple way by Tara Rinpoche. And so it totally stuck in my mind and totally transformed the way I thought about Buddhist practice and Buddhism. So it became sort of a practice that when I was attentive enough and not completely stupid and lazy and so on and so forth, I would engage in, like cooking meals in the Zen Center's kitchen. It became a big thing for me to do this, do it in the Zen Center. So I really am working my way back to this passage from Thich Nhat Hanh, because when he talks about taking refuge in the Buddha, and then the Buddha is taking refuge in me, what he says is that in the relationship between myself and the Buddha, and what he means is not necessarily the Buddha Shakyamuni Buddha, but he means the Buddha in everybody. And what he really means is like the superficial me taking refuge in the deeper me. Okay? Or the superficial me taking refuge in the deeper Teresa, because it's between all of us. That when we form a relationship with each other where we recognize how we depend on each other to cultivate our own best features, then we have a spiritual practice going on. So when I recognize that what goes on between myself and Kay is you can get angry in this particular moment and be frustrated and be a pain in the ass to her, or you can recognize that this particular moment is an opportunity to be in a different way in relationship with her. And if I'm thinking that she created the opportunity, I can either get angry at her, like, why did you do that thing and I'm pissed off at you? Or I can think to myself, oh, you did that thing, and I can either get pissed off at you, or it's an opportunity for me to practice patience and forbearance and loving kindness, and you're my wife, and I love you. Why would I want to get angry with you? Because in 30 years, we're probably both going to be dead. Isn't that stupid to get angry with you now? Of course, I still get angry with her, because, you know, I'm an ordinary human being like everybody else. But it is a practice that we can adopt, at least sometimes. And when we adopt that practice, at least sometimes, then we are really recognizing the way we depend on each other for everything, including our own growth and our own good feeling, and that You know, I mean, I can't experience love without my wife. I mean, she's the opportunity for my experience of that sentiment. You know? I mean, and that's another part of love. It's not just I love her because she's sweet, we've been together, and so on and so forth. There's more going on there. She's an opportunity. I know that sounds a little strange, but she is. She's an opportunity to experience love. Do you remember the Jefferson Airplane song from the 60s? Yeah, but I always thought that it was very deep. Don't you need somebody to love? You really do, you know? Because if you don't have somebody, it's not just that you have somebody, but you have the opportunity to experience love. And it's not just like they're there to meet your needs. They are an opportunity to experience love.
So were they Buddhists, Jefferson Airplane?
Probably, among other things. But so then the flip side to it, and this is where certain practices come in, they're called mind training, which is that your adversary is an opportunity to practice something too. Now this is where it gets really hard, right? Okay. It's easy to practice love with Kay. That's no problem at all, except when we're arguing about the drip system perhaps. But I mean, you know, it's harder to practice certain kinds of more positive feelings when you're dealing with people who you see as adversaries. I mean, there are certain people in my life who really seem like adversaries because of repeating situations that come up in a work context or in a community context in the larger sense. They keep coming back over and over again, and they seem like adversaries to me. And it's very hard to practice anything with them, except my spontaneous frustration and anger. That's easy. But real practice would be to understand interdependence of our relationship with them in a different way, in a complex way. Now, to sort of wrap this up, so obviously now I've looped back to Thich Nhat Hanh and how this entire talk is dependent on the kindness of Carolyn, who doesn't have to be here right now. But I said I would say a little bit about emptiness and what that means, because when Buddhists talk about emptiness, it seems like a really difficult philosophical concept and so on and so forth. And in its own way, it actually is. It's very deep and very profound. And Kayla and April will say that's true because the first day they went to the Dalai Lama's teachings in New York, that's all he talked about, and their heads exploded, and they felt like, oh, God, you know, this is really hard. But I don't know what he said, but what he probably said was along the lines of, when you see that things are dependent on their entire history and all the causes and the conditions that brought them about, and that things are dependent in many other kinds of ways, what you're seeing is that they are not autonomous, that they're not self-sufficient, that they're not what they seem to be when you first look at them. That when you look at them more deeply, there's something other than what they first seem to be. And so in Buddhist lingo, that's saying that your experience of that phenomenon, both experience of the phenomenon and the phenomenon, are empty of your projected fantasies about them. That it's empty of your belief that it's independent. It's empty of your belief that it's autonomous. It's empty of its appearance of being independent, of being autonomous. It's empty of its seeming to not be connected to its entire past history. And that's one way of understanding emptiness. I mean, emptiness gets interpreted many ways in Buddhist thought, but that's usually the way the Dalai Lama would talk about it. That's the way Thar Rinpoche taught us about it. So that's sort of like emptiness. It's just the flip side. It's just the shorthand for talking about what I just talked about this evening. That the reality is the way everything connects. And not seeing that is what we typically see. And when you empty your experience of the fantasies you have and the fictions you have and the avidya, the misknowledge, then you see things for what they really are. And you see them as being empty of your fantasies about them, among other things. And you see them as being empty of their independence. So some other time, maybe we'll talk about why they picked that term, emptiness. But anyway. So, then there's one other thing that I'll add to this that's about interdependence and dependent origination, same terms. That there's also a mysterious side to this, and I'm sure this will lead to some Q&A later. There's also a mysterious side to all of this. And the mysterious side is, how is it that certain things show up to bug us so consistently? For example, on the corner here, we have a dog that is really noisy.
Yes, it is.
And I've called, you know, city animal control about this and tried to figure out what to do about it. And I'm going to go talk to the neighbors about it, but I don't really want to get in conflict with them. So anyway, without going on about all of that kind of stuff, what I have noticed is, on a perfectly quiet morning like this morning, when for some completely inexplicable reason the dog is hardly making any noise at all, as soon as I sit down and meditate and start doing my practice, yeah, it just goes. He just takes off. And this has happened more than once. So now I have to ask myself, why is it that this particular dog is making special racket as soon as I sit down to meditate? I mean, he makes a racket all the time, but he can be quiet for an hour and then he'll start up. So what is that about? And I really got to thinking about it this morning, because it happened again at 10 o'clock this morning. I had a nice leisurely morning, and I finally got to my practice at 10 o'clock, and I was enjoying how quiet it was this morning. It was so still here this morning. It was so quiet. It was tangible quiet. And as soon as I crossed my legs and started doing my prayers, literally as soon as I did that, he went to town. And I have to ask myself, what is going on between that dog and myself? And I don't have an answer to that particular question. And I don't know what to do about, you know, yappy dog across the street. There is some mystery to the way we're connected too that we don't understand, and I kind of wanted to end with mystery. Okay?